You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildopedia. Joining us today is Madalena Calpo from Smartstone. Welcome, Madalena.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. And how are you going today? How's things? How's life treating you?
Loving life. Sun's out. Been, you know, enjoying this day from this office room. So no complaints at all. No complaints.
We normally kick off an episode with an inspiration. So just as a bit of an icebreaker, a bit of a warm-up, have you got an inspiration to share?
Yes, actually I do. At the moment, one of my inspirations, and I am probably going to already jump into stone a bit early, but I'm very passionate about it.
Go for it.
One of my clients, MIM Design Studio down in Melbourne, they are a fantastic studio and they've been ever inspiring me to think of new colours and new palettes to bring to the Smartstone range. So one of the designers down there, Charlotte, has been giving me some great inspiration on some new colours and materials we'll be working on next year. So big inspo from MIM Design.
Okay, now that you've said that, what are the colours?
I don't know if I can divulge this information.
Well, yet. You're going to have to now that you've inspired us.
There's definitely a colour that they've mentioned called Taj Mahal, which is like a beautiful sort of beigey looking onyx colour that's definitely on our radar. And yeah, there's a few others up my sleeve, but I'll keep them as a secret.
Okay. And we always have this funny conversation with my design team anyway, where they are adamant that architects, like real architects, don't follow trends. Like they're artists and
they're trendsetters, of course.
Yeah, they don't. No one follows trends in architecture, right? So what's your view on that? Because I'm kind of going, they're all copying each other, really.
It's interesting. We kind of have to balance what we see, like in terms of trends that are going to come through, what we see is viable and what we can see sticking and rolling out down to the retail market, and then what we see is a fleeting moment or a trend that's going to come and go quickly. So we've kind of got to balance that, okay, what's hot, what's coming through, what are designers loving working with, and then what are we seeing translate for the next 2 years into like a more mass market application. So we've got to be risky, but balance that with a bit of conservative thinking when we think about the mass benchtop market.
So is that the same as like in fashion, you have that outrageous costume that they wear on the catwalk that you could never really wear?
100%, you know, and there's amazing colours that are coming through. Like there's so much blue and so many like fun sort of tones of stone and amazing things that the designers are using at the moment. But for us to pick that up isn't always viable. So we've got to kind of enjoy that moment, watch it from afar, and then still stick in our lane of what we think is going to stick for mums and dads in their homes and looking at, are people going to use blue in their kitchen? Is that going to be a thing? So,
well, it could be.
Yeah, it could be. You never know. You never know.
I'm going to consider blue in my kitchen. But I won't promise that I'll use it. But
I think it's a very peaceful colour to live around. So you might be honest.
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, we'll keep going. I have an inspiration too, and I'm reading this. From now on, when I say reading, I'm listening because I listen to audiobooks. I don't really read a lot. But there's a book that I've been listening to called Super Communicators, and I haven't even bothered to look up the author, which I should have done, but we'll post it in the link. But it is occasionally, like I listen to a lot of audiobooks. Some of them I just don't get to the end of, but this one tells great stories. Like it's really gripping in a good way. Just it sticks to my brain.
What story stuck the most?
Well, I think they're all kind of stories about experiments in communication and connection. And it's all about, so the book is really all about connecting on a deeper level with people around you. It takes a little bit of a professional angle, but it's really a book about what it is about people who connect with other people in a positive, good way, and unpacks that in experiments. So it talks about experiments. It talks about a legal case that where the jury had what they described as a super communicator that turned the jury process into a positive thing and created a good outcome, where it was an open shut case for a confused poor person who was stuck with the law and technically broke the law, and they turned turned that around and really just went, well, we all want to acquit this person because this is ridiculous. They were never going to harm anyone, but technically they broke the law. How do we come to a not guilty decision on? So that was a really interesting, like, because it, but very well written.
Oh, and it's so nice to see things from different perspectives and see how people can use communication as such a tool, especially people that are like yourself, very good at it. So I'm going to have to read that book. I've just read
it. It is good. It is very good. It's one of the books. It's that one in 20 books that's like that. This is good. This is a good book.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for that recommendation. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people listening to it now.
Okay. So jumping into today's topic, we're talking about stone and particularly engineered stone, and which was banned as of the, if I'm not mistaken, 1st of July. Of 2024, a ban came into effect banning a stone. And it's not just like any other product. It arguably was the most popular benchtop splashback product.
On the market.
Very much ubiquitous.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, very much taking market share from natural stone and other stones. So it was very much a flip in the market or a change of consequence. Not just at the margins, right? It was a upheaval in that part of the industry.
Yeah, massively. And I think it's going to be sort of an interesting to watch, I guess, what happens internationally as well with this, I guess, case that's come up in Australia. We've been the first in the world to sort of ban this and to see, you know, what's going to happen in different countries overseas and see how everyone else handles it. But definitely, I think why we see such a quick impact is because of how popular engineered stone was in Australia. Caesar stone at one point in time, like Australia was Caesar stone's biggest market in the world. That was, we were the biggest buyers of Caesar stone internationally as a country. So that's been interesting to see, like how that's sort of, you know, impacted now, leaving so many people with different options to have to look for. There's so many designers and architects that have had these types of products as a go-to. So yeah, it's been interesting.
I'm just going back one step. So tell us about SmartStone, the company that you're obviously working for, representing today. Tell us a bit about where they sit in the market and what it is about SmartStone that's interesting, I guess.
100%. Wonderful. So the history of the brand is quite interesting. It spans, I guess, SmartStone as a brand has been around for quite a while. It was rebranded under the ownership of a man named Con, who took the business over around 10 years ago. He rebranded SmartStone, but his previous experience was actually importing a product called Caesarstone, which I mentioned earlier. So he brought Caesarstone to the Australian market with Jerry Harvey from Harvey Norman, which was the previous business the two of them were working in, which was quite interesting. So Con and Jerry had obviously been running the kitchen renovation business at Harvey Norman, which back in the day was the biggest kitchen retailer. If you were renovating a kitchen, you would go to Harvey Norman and work with one of the designers there to design and build your kitchen. So yeah, they were overseas. Con was overseas at a fair one year looking at different products. And previously, before engineered stone was a thing, granite and laminate were the two products that were predominantly specified in the Harvey Norman kitchens. And suddenly they found this product that was just like this super product. So they decided to, yeah, bring that back to Australia and start distributing the product.
And that was Caesarstone, right?
That was Caesarstone, yes.
And what year was that?
That was, I'm thinking that was maybe 99, 2000, they were doing that. Yep. So 25 years ago, which is, yeah, amazing to see, just well before my time in the industry. But yeah, so they ran that for 10 years and that's what grew the market share of Caesarstone in Australia. So at the time they grew it to be Caesarstone's biggest international market. And yeah, the stonemasons just loved the product. It was something really easy to sell to a designer because they absolutely loved the performances of it. And the stonemasons loved it because it was much easier to fabricate than marble or granite. It was quicker, it was softer to cut, it was faster to cut. So yeah, the handling was really easy. So yeah, that's kind of, I guess, why that product grew. But I think it was also consumers and designers loving this product that was a solid, hard surface that performed way better than laminate, that didn't mark, it didn't stain, it was fairly heat resistant. Yeah, it just filled this amazing gap in the market where people, if you didn't have a big budget and you couldn't afford marble, this was going to be a really good substitute, you know, if you wanted something more luxurious than a laminate benchtop.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. And so then SmartStone, I guess my experience is of Stone and Caesar Stone is that, I guess, working as a contract builder, like the architect would specify a Caesar Stone. And of course, the joiner would have an alternative, which was more cost effective. So was that SmartStone was one of those?
Yeah, well, that's probably at the start, we were more cost effective than Caesar Stone when SmartStone first came out around 10 years ago, but when it was rebranded. But for us, the focus was really the technology. So SmartStone was the first company to bring out a jumbo slab. So they used to be smaller slabs around 3050 by 1500, which is what a lot of the suppliers are still providing.
Which is 3 meters by 1.5 meters for 1.5, those yes, not in yeah. the industry.
Yes, sorry. And then SmartStone was the first to bring out a 3.2 by 1.6. What that meant is then you could then design an island bench and a back bench out of the one sheet of material, saving having to use two and then having offcuts. So it was a really good tool to then maximize cost, you know, maximize how much of the material you're using, minimize the waste, and also reduce the cost for the client, which was halving the material needed to be used. So that was a really big move. We were the first to do that. We were also the first to bring out veined engineered stone. So Caesar Stone used to only supply solid colors or that sort of terrazzo chip style, which is in most people's kitchens. But SmartStone was the first to then move our manufacturing facilities out of Europe and into China, where the best, you know, engineers and technicians were working out of. The investment was going there in terms of technology, and these amazing engineers were coming up with these machines where we could inject veining into these slabs. So that was a really big move for us as well. So yeah, that's kind of what our angle was. And then the last few years, it's been constant product development and innovation, which I can definitely speak a little bit more about.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the background of SmartStone. And what do you do at SmartStone, Adelina? What's your role and what's your typical day?
I will let you in on a little secret. I am a relative of Cons. He is my father. So I am in the business by blood.
Yeah, right, cool. Right. So it's a family business.
It is a family business. My brother's also in the business. He looks after all of the stonemasons, but I predominantly service architects and designers in the industry. I also do product development with the research and development team, so producing all the new colors, forecasting what those are going to be, and chopping and changing as we go, which is really fun. I also do a bit of event management, so people that are in the industry may have seen me on the stand at the design show or at the ARC events if you're attending any of those events. But yeah, so a little bit of everything, but I predominantly work with sort of key architects, developers, and builders in Sydney.
Yeah, yeah, cool. So a lot of your role is just meeting architects and talking to them about colours and then selling your wares, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. And working on, the fun part is working on sort of custom details. I do have a client in Sydney that is often requesting, you know, trying something new, seeing how we can finish the product differently, seeing if we can curve it or come up with some really unique details. So that's really my sort of passion, is to work with those types of clients and come up with some really unique design solutions, see how far we can push the product. So that would be my favorite part.
So you set the scene for us, that, you know, huge market, huge, I don't know, you can come back in a sec if you've got any numbers around the volume the volume or the dollar value, but massive. Like, I guess, because not only was it a budget option, there were also quite custom, and I'm talking about engineered stone generally. There were lots of colors options, stone lookalikes. So there was some very expensive pieces, and engineered stone captured the whole market from the very basic reno, the cost-effective market, the project home or the budget renovation, all the way to the most expensive home.
Yeah, 100%. And top homeowners that, you know, that had a marble kitchen, but they may have a laundry with engineered stone because it was practical. So 100%, we would be constantly servicing all different parts of the market. Now it's changed. But yeah, at the time that was, you know, it was a mass market product anyone would look at having engineered stone.
And it all came to an end, like all of
yeah
that whole episode wrapped up earlier this year. And so I guess maybe we'll unpack why. So talk us through what the problem was and why the ban and how did it come about?
So obviously I won't go into too much detail because it is a topic that is a tricky one to speak about. But obviously from the process of the stonemasons incorrectly fabricating the product. So obviously there's, you know, certain regulation and certain rules that were meant to be followed when fabricating this product. Sadly, particular people didn't follow this advice and were dry cutting the material that we were supplying. And at the end of the day, the process of dry cutting resulted in, you know, some really horrible things. And we, as a supplier, it's a hard thing to regulate and to keep track of that processing of the material. Once we have sold the slab, it's on the responsibility, I guess, of the stonemason to correctly fabricate it, wear PPE and cut with copious amounts of water, not to be dry cutting. So yeah, it was a tricky time. And for us, we've really spent the last 4 years trying to come up with material and different ways of sort of reducing this risk. But yeah, at the end of the day, that was obviously a real tragedy. And I think for us moving forward, we're feeling very positive about the materials we've provided. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on why that's really eradicating the process of dry cutting from a supplier point of view. That was one of our sort of major things we've considered when we've come to supplying new product in the market. But yeah, so it's been a very tough 4 years for the whole industry. And yeah, we're really excited to see WorkCover, you know, coming on board and really heavily regulating this new trade and looking at how, you know, safe practices can be put in play, what that new legislation's looking like. So there's new legislation coming out soon, which is sort of implicating what that space is going to be looking like moving forward.
Yeah, and of course we won't go because we're not qualified for a start to look into the illness itself, but it was what part of the stone or what particular aspect of dry cutting and was the problem, because people still, obviously natural stone's not banned and other products aren't banned. So what was it about engineered stone that was so problematic?
Engineered stone was manufactured of two key components. One was quartz, which is the seventh hardest mineral in the world, and it's what gave the material the strength that it did. Quartz is a fairly cost-effective mineral to mine, combined with resin, polymer resins. So when you combine those two products, you heat it, not to a very high temperature, you press it, and that is what makes the, you know, binds the product. You obviously add pigments and other smaller ingredients, but that was the majority of the product. So the engineered stone at the time was being made with the highest sort of concentration was around 95% quartz. The quartz was the crystalline silica component. So that is what was the majority of the, I guess, all the silica that was in the material. And the resin was the material that allowed them to cut it so easily. So binding it with resin, I guess, was the glue of the material. That was what was, I guess, not legally allowing them to dry cut it, but physically you could put a blade through that material because it had resin in it and not have to cut it with water because the material wouldn't crack because of the resin binding it, unlike, you know, obviously some different products that we'll speak about. So obviously with marble, it's a little bit more fragile, so you have to work a little bit more carefully. The difference as well with a natural marble, it has, you know, around less than 2% crystalline silica level in it. So there's different levels of marbles. If you look at, for instance, like a sandstone, that's got anywhere between 70 and 90%. So that's going to be a really interesting space to see how they regulate, you know, the cutting of sandstone bricks and pillars and things like that. Granite has anywhere between sort of 40 and 60% crystalline silica. So yeah, I think that hasn't been the main concern because the product that had been cut in volume was engineered stone. And at the end of the day, that had, you know, anywhere between 90 and 98% crystalline silica across all of the different brands for that reason. And that's the particle that they're obviously concerned with.
I might be off on a tangent. I might be completely wrong. Is crystal silica, is that not sand?
Yes. Yeah, technically, anything that comes out of the ground has some sort of level of silica in it. The crystalline silica is obviously just a particular type of silica that was coming from the quartz. But at the end of the day, sandstone's going to have crystalline silica. Whether you're digging a hole, mining a tunnel, you know, working with bricks, concrete, tiles, anything has crystalline silica. The issue has been around the cutting of that material and the high concentration in engineered stone.
Yeah, and I guess the resin as it cuts.
It's like what allowed, I guess looking at it in hindsight, that was the component that allowed them to cut it. And it's not that it stopped, you know, other trades out there from dry cutting. You can see across construction sites, it's not something that has completely ceased. Obviously, engineered stone was under a quite a big spotlight watching that sort of roll out. But I think, yeah, the resin was the binding agent that allowed the material to be soft enough to lay through it dry, if that kind of makes sense. So, but you know what, at the end of the day, that's only from our perspective. You could have everyone else say something completely different, but that's from our observation, what we saw.
I mean, people just do what they do. Look, you can't. I mean, I remember once going to one of my sites. I was project managing for another company that I work for, and turn up and there's just a plume of dust. Someone's cutting something and there's a plume coming out. And I get in there and I won't mention who it was or what they were doing, but, you know, one of the carpenters, and I'm like, what are you doing? And where's your mask? And he's like,
seriously.
And he goes, I've got a ciggy in my mouth. I'm just breathing through the filter.
No comment on that.
Oh, my God. It's just, look, people do what they do, and it's a tough ship to turn around. And it's not because they're stupid or bad people, but habit, like, we all have habits that are hard to break, and you build a habit and you do things a particular way and it's very hard to break, and people do what they do. That's the way it goes, and they try and do things the easiest way possible. You can't blame them.
The quickest way possible. Like, that's, you're out of the habit, like you're saying. But I think that moving forward with this legislation coming through, this has just been the most positive thing for the industry. Like, to see a regulator come through and take real authority and really have a presence in this space has been absolutely vital for us moving forward. You know, supplying material, we want to feel supported by, you know, the regulator as well. And we absolutely do. So yeah, this is a really, I think it's a great space to be in now that it's obviously been cleaned up quite a bit.
Yeah. And so what is the replacement? Because I guess my experience as a design and our practices in architecture, but I mean, when we were kind of told, okay, here's the alternative, it kind of looks a little bit like the old but new. So what is actually changing? Like, what's the difference?
I think I can only speak from our experience. So I might sort of just do a quick recap of what we have created in the last few years and what that's gotten us to arrive at the product that we're now obviously distributing. So we originally, around 4 years ago, when the first, I think it was around 2019, when the first cases of silicosis were arising in the industry, and we started to realize, I guess, the impact that the product we were distributing at the time was having on the industry. You know, regardless of the regulation that was in play, we straight off the bat went, oh my gosh, if this is the reality of this product, we need to shift really quickly away from it and come up with something that was going to be, you know, a viable option for us moving forward. So at the time, the first decision we made was to distribute a product called Atlas Plan. It was a 12 mil porcelain surface from Italy that was absolutely stunning. You know, we loved this product. It was really exciting to bring something to the industry that was a completely new aesthetic. So it wasn't a injected vein. It was a printed surface on a large porcelain tile, the same size as our slabs that we were already supplying. So that was an exciting product to bring through the market. But we had a bit of hesitation. The stonemasons did not want to cut a porcelain. They weren't willing to, but some were, some absolutely were on board with porcelain, but others didn't want to have to change their tooling or their techniques to be able to cut this product. It's also a slower material to process. So it meant, again, like we were talking about, having to slow your speeds down, work a little bit more, you know, slowly handle the material a little bit differently. That wasn't really flying with the stonemasons at the time. So that was a proactive thing for us to do to bring through this material. It had, I think it had around less than 20% silica. So we'd been able to sort of bring through a material that had a really reduced level. But for us at the time, the thing we didn't realize that was so beneficial about it is that you could not dry cut porcelain. It was physically impossible to dry cut it because it's a much harder material. So that was a really, you know, it was a great thing at the time, but it just didn't take off with the stonemasons. They weren't ready to upskill and they weren't ready to work a little bit more slowly with benchtop services because, you know, and the industry was booming. It was through that time in COVID where everyone was renovating. They didn't need to have to adopt those new skills and those new techniques. So yeah, we saw a little bit of hesitation. So on the side of that, we were also developing our engineered stone category to see if we could reduce the silica level. So alongside some other suppliers, we were one of the first brands to bring out a reduced silica engineered stone surface. So we brought out a product called the Ibrido Collection. So it was a hybrid engineered stone. It was printed and combined with a vein. And that was made of 56% recycled glass. And the glass element allowed us to reduce the silica. So we removed some of the quartz, subbed it in with glass and reduced that down to less than 28% silica, which was fantastic. Then after that, we rolled that composition out across our key offerings. So all of our sort of classic engineered stones were then seen to have less than 28% silica. And then, yeah, we thought, okay, that's where we're at. We've got everything below 30%. The government at the time was sort of pushing for all the suppliers to get their products below 40% silica content. So, you know, we assumed that we had become compliant as per what we thought were going to be the new sort of legislation coming through. And sort of around January of last year of
2023,
yes, we started hearing whispers and we were obviously then soon getting advice from particular agencies that this was not going to be the compliant level of silica in surfaces as per what I guess the government were going to push for. The message shortly after changed and we were hearing that they were going to ban all levels of crystalline silica and engineered stone. So they were pushing to have legislation that was going to say the product was needing to be less than 1%.
Yeah, right. So is that what happened?
That's what happened, but it didn't happen until December of last year. So that was announced in December. We were sort of catching wind of it in January of last year. So what we started doing is then creating two more alternatives to the three that we had already made because we went, we've got to be below 0% silica, below 1%, or we have to bring out a completely new category of product that wasn't going to sit or be deemed as engineered stone. So we went and created a zero silica material that was completely made of glass and resin. We thought that that was going to be a really great option moving forward for us if we could achieve the performance in terms of staining, scratching, marking, heat, UV resistance. We needed it not to bow and we needed it to perform, you know, the same as engineered stone in everyone's kitchens. Sadly, that product did not perform nearly where we needed it to be. The material after doing tests, several tests, keep in mind we were prototyping that in January of last year. We spent 2 months just starting to test all the samples and work with it. It was discoloring with UV exposure. It was scratching like crazy. It was staining. It was marking. The slabs were bowing, which meant they weren't flat. So when the stonemasons went to cut them and then glue a miter or do an edge, the material wasn't straight.
So it obviously wasn't going to work at all.
It wasn't going to work. Yeah, and actually, just I'll add one thing there. The reason why it didn't work was now because we substituted the quartz for glass, glass was a much finer material. So what we had to do is combine double the amount of resin than what we previously had in engineered stone. So the resin content went from like 8% to something crazy like 16 or 18% just to bind it. And that's what set off all the issues. So it was forming more like a solid surface than it was an engineered stone.
Yeah. So you had you were a little bit stuck because you were prototyping things that weren't going to work and the other things you prototype weren't going to be acceptable by the new standard. So you were a little bit of a panic in the company or a little bit of a...
I don't think it was a panic. I think it was a really exciting opportunity for us to innovate. I think being, you know, having this really...
Is that code for panic?
No, because we had time, because we knew we had time under our sleeve, because we were really, I think the key word for us was being proactive. Everything we did was because of the last few years of innovation and technology. Bear in mind, a lot of our competition was still supplying in January last year, high silica engineered stone. We had transitioned our complete offering to be less than 40. So we were already 10, 20 steps ahead of what a lot of other suppliers were doing in the industry. So that's why it wasn't a panic, because we knew we had time up our sleeve. So as we were doing the zero silica prototypes, we were also doing another product, which is what you see us with Mark in the market with today, which is our sintered collection. These amazing 20 mil thick, full vein bodied porcelain surfaces. So yeah, we tweaked this material quite a lot, because we saw that with the traditional porcelain, there were some hesitations from stonemasons. The architects were looking for more in terms of body veining. They didn't want a product that just was a white line in the base. So yeah, that was where we landed, and we wouldn't look back if we could. We just, you know, we feel like we've come leaps and bounds since.
Yeah. So tell us what sintered stone is. Like, what's the difference?
So there's two kind of terminologies out there for this category of product. It all sits within the umbrella of porcelain. Sintering just purely means baking at a really high temperature. So tiles are sintered. Anything that's heated to that sort of 1200 degrees, which is what our product's baked at. Yeah, that's that sintering process. So it's called the sintered collection, but it does classify as a porcelain, which you can see in the new legislation coming through, doesn't fall within the category of engineered stone. And that is the category that's being heavily regulated. Porcelain is not of a concern, and it sits with natural stone in that category.
And what is porcelain? Like, what is the, what's inside porcelain?
Yeah, it's kaolin, talc, feldspar. And yeah, some, obviously that's sort of the main sort of makeup of that product. It's pretty much a tile. So what everyone's seeing on their tiles in their bathrooms, that's sort of the main composition of what a ceramic, I guess a ceramic or a porcelain tile is. Our material is, though, the key difference, I guess, is it's 20 mil thick. And the key feature of this, and no one's sort of perfected this technology bar us yet, which is a very biased thing to say, but the material speaks for itself, is the fact that our material has veining through the body of the porcelain. This is not a standard thing. Most tiles, if you cut into a tile, it's just a white biscuit, a gray biscuit corresponding to the sort of tones of the print. Whereas with these materials, wherever you cut through the material, you get an amazing sort of vein that runs through that. So it just means for benchtops, you can just polish the edge and it looks extremely realistic. It looks nearly like a natural stone.
Okay, so Madalena, tell us the price. How is the price affected? Because obviously, I mean, in terms of the economics, you've had to spend a bit of money, like flipping things over, and innovation sucks a lot of money, and also, I guess, a new product, new tooling, new everything, and new, right down to new sales brochures and new training and like what. So how's that, all of that impacted the price?
Yeah, so I think for us, we have been extremely, again, proactive and really considerate about how this new product and the mass market supply of this is going to impact the stonemason's quote. That was a major consideration when bringing out this product. We needed to know we were coming to the market with a good price, a stonemason could cut it, his fabrication cost could be covered, and it still be a feasible option for consumers. The price difference, I would say the material is on par on cost. What we used to supply and what we supply now, it's practically the same price. So consumers are not going to see an increase, a major increase, unless they're picking the top range and they want a beautiful color cut of Viola, which is a gorgeous product. That would sit price-wise with our top engineered stone colors anyway. So material supply isn't the issue. Where we're seeing the changes happening right now is in the cost of the fabrication of the product. So the cost, it's what the stonemasons are charging to cut our material, is what is the more sort of difficult space for consumers to be navigating. So we've got two kind of streams of clients out there at the moment. Those that are really invested in moving forward with the industry, those that are keen to keep working with products like porcelain, investing in the tools, investing in the machinery, and continuously learning about the fabrication process, how they can work with it better. And then those that are really not interested in doing that, which is absolutely fine. But sadly, our client base has shifted a little bit. We've had to really work with those that have that future-focused vision, can see where this material's heading and really supportive of that. They would be the people that we would recommend and say are most cost-effective to work with.
Yeah, so bringing it back to price, is it then true that there's more labor involved in the new product than traditionally in? And I guess part of that factor might be that maybe corners were cut in the production traditionally for engineered stone, so they cut it as cheaply and effectively as they could on the back of a truck or wherever they were. So maybe part of that is actually having to cut it differently. But has production cost gone up?
Production cost. So if you were to compare a standard, like the stonemason, you know, doing the right thing, cutting the product correctly, the cost increase for someone that maybe is transitioning into cutting a little bit of porcelain here and there, you could see an increase in the fabrication, not the material cost, the fabrication cost, maybe anywhere between 20 and 30%. So that's the jump. It's not in the material. It's in the speeds. They're having to work slower, you know, just a little bit slower. But I have to say, the stonemasons that are working with this material and have their whole factory set up to fabricate porcelain, we're not seeing much of a price difference at all. And we're even like cost effective with the engineered stone suppliers, the guys that are doing zero silicas and those types of products. We can still be competitive with those guys. It just has to be working alongside stonemasons that have invested in that, because those that haven't, you know, will struggle to price it well, because then, you know, they don't have the skill set. They might break a slab or two in the process. Whereas the guys that are skilled up, that know exactly what they're doing, they're cutting that at the same speed as engineered stone, which is for us quite impressive.
And I guess the other factor in all of this is just the leap in labor costs, because in construction anyway, and I'm presuming the same can be said for manufacturing, because we see the price hikes in anything that in the last 4 years, prices seemingly doubled for any material that needed processing, like flashings or anything really, but the prices just kept going up, and generally like construction costs are up. So I think has that been compounded a little bit in terms of the production?
Well, it's hard for us. We haven't had a price increase since we brought out the pricing for this material in March when we launched it. We haven't had a price increase all year. So I can only speak from a supply point of view, but yeah, fabrication, the stonemasons, that's a hard, I can't speak on behalf of them, but I'm sure some of them, you know, are feeling that. I think it depends what category, what part of the industry they're servicing as well. Like, we have stonemasons that do predominantly commercial multi-residential building. Then we have others that will, focus on working with kitchen companies. And then we've got others that are doing, you know, working with interior designers, doing big multi-million homes worth of stone. So there's lots of different types of clients servicing different types of the industry. But yeah, I can't speak too much on behalf of them, but some are busier than others. It fluctuates. It always changes.
Yeah, yeah. And what about other, have other alternatives taken market share? Because, so one thing that we're using in our practice a lot more than we used to is laminate. And once upon a time, we would run away from laminate because it was very limited in its colors and presentation and range, but it was also not very durable. And we've seen that both of those things have evolved, where now we can put laminate, even we can use it in a kitchen bench top. It's heat resistant, it's water resistant. Once upon a time, we would have never used it in a bathroom. We would have run away from them, or insisted that wasn't going to happen. But we've softened on that somewhat because it kind of works now. So has that taken market share away from traditional?
I'm biased because I think we've got to look at what trades we're servicing. Laminate will go to a cabinet maker. So it's not a space that we see we haven't directly felt the implications of that. I don't think that people looking for stone are going back to laminate. I think people that are looking at people that need a budget orientated option where engineered stone may have sort of the bottom end of that market, you could have been accessible to some. Now it isn't. Sometimes, you know, especially with porcelain, the fabrication's gone up that 20-30%. Some people, it may not fit their budget. So I think that's where probably sort of that end of the market, we're seeing a lot of home builders sort of maybe shift towards laminate. But in terms of the retail market and interior designers, they're definitely still looking for stone benchtops. For us, where the jump has been to now offer something that has far superior performances over engineered stone. So where offering this material that's UV resistant and pretty much heat resistant, you can put your pots and pans off the flame onto it, right onto the benchtop. So we're kind of like having to push the performances a little bit further. But yeah, in terms of laminate, no, that's not something we're directly impacted by. And we still see the volume of stone through the industry at a really high volume. It's just obviously mixed between now porcelain, really high volume and natural stone. So that's where we've seen the shift. A lot of people through that sort of era of all the issues in engineered stone made the new go-to natural stone, which I love. I can't even, you know, I think, you know, there's some amazing suppliers of natural stone out there, one of which I have a good friend. His name's Nathan from Cavard. And, you know, just seeing like these guys bring out some really beautiful products, we're often sort of like working with each other. If the client doesn't want an end, you know, want a porcelain for their island because they want to have that feature, they'll go with a marble and then the backbench will be the porcelain where they want that practical space. So, yeah, that's kind of where we're seeing the shift in the stone space. And then obviously there's that new category of product, the zero silica, which some suppliers have decided to commit to and move forward with. But yeah, for us, that's kind of the three major products, I'd say, the zero silica engineered, the porcelain and the natural stone.
And what questions, I guess, if someone's about to choose a benchtop or is having that discussion with their architect or maybe just wanting to do it themselves, and what should they look for? What questions should they ask before they choose a product?
I think the two biggest questions I would ask is aesthetically, what do you want? Do you want a vein? Do you want, you know, a solid color? Do you want a concrete look? Like that's going to really dictate aesthetically what your options are. You know, if you want a gorgeous concrete look, you could go concrete. You could go a porcelain tile that looks like concrete. You could go engineered stone that looks like concrete. Like there's lots of different realms. So the aesthetic element would be the one. The second would be the performance. What do you want out of your benchtop? What do you want to be able to use your kitchen for? Do you want to be able to put your pot straight off your, you know, flame onto the benchtop? Some people want that. Some people are lazy, you know, don't want to have to put a mat down or a trivet and protect their surface. So for that kind of client, I would say don't use a marble. Don't ruin a marble. You know, if you're going to go down that realm, you've got to really have the patience to take care for it, to nurture it, to, you know, seal that surface. If you're making that investment, I think you've got to not be that other consumer that really wants to just be sort of, you know, blasé and just have this really practical surface. If it's budget, you go to laminate and you pick something that's really cost effective, you know, if your budget's not going to allow you to sort of have a stone surface. But yeah, in terms of performances, like, yeah, and I'm going to speak really biased because I think it's an ultimate product, but you can pour red wine, you can pour turmeric, you know, coffee, you can pour all these things on this material. It's actually chemical resistant and it's non-combustible. So yeah, it depends. And then if you're doing a barbecue, what are you doing outside? You're using a material like a granite that's really hard, or you're using a porcelain because it's UV stable. So I think it just comes down to what do they want performance-wise out of their benchtop surfaces and what's going to meet that aesthetically as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's
very biased answer, sorry.
That's okay. I guess we're just to balance the bias, I guess we're one of the things about using laminate is that you can match it to any color or cabinet. So it gives the designer ultimate freedom of color and you can create something. So I guess we're actually using some laminates in some pretty up spec kitchens as well. Like, so they're not all budget options. They, you can actually create some great effects, but I guess it's never, yeah, to be fair, it's never going to be as durable. You can't just put a pot down on it.
Pot on it. Yeah. But for joinery and like, especially when you're doing some really beautiful custom joinery, like aesthetically that is gorgeous, especially when you have that really sort of clean, minimal look. I think that 100%. And look, we've got to the point where we even, with some previous collection, started designing stone to match particular popular laminates. Like that designer I mentioned at the start, MIM Design, you know, they have some core laminate colors they work with. And they said, we need a match. Can you create some colors that complement this? And I went off and did that, which was amazing. So, you know, we looked at a color like Surf from Laminex, which is one of the most specified laminate colors in the industry, and actually created a complement because, you know, their clients were needing that stone performance. But again, it's that cohesive, really minimal aesthetic that sits behind their beautiful marble islands. So I think it's all interwoven, and I think that every sort of material has its place. But yeah, that would be my sort of take on that.
Yeah, and my number one tip probably would be let your design, if you're paying a designer, let them help you choose, let them create a coherent kitchen or whatever that space is. Because yeah, what I found a few times is clients love a particular look or a particular stone or a particular, and they love and want to have that, and arguably it's not the best choice in that context. So context is everything. You got to understand how that bench top or whatever it is fits into the whole, how it fits into the whole space, right? Because the most beautiful piece of stone in the wrong place doesn't look right.
And that's why they come into you, you know what I mean? That's why you consult with a designer, because their whole, you know, they have the planning, they have the vision, they can see these materials in place. But the thing that I think people often forget is what a big commitment stone is too. Like, it is a big volume of material in your kitchen, especially if you're doing waterfall ends. Like, to pick a stone finish from a tile is a very hard thing to do because it is such, you know, a cumbersome sort of material in that space. You're right. It's hard when your clients fall in love with something that's really stunning to then figure out how to detail that and pull that back sometimes is something we see happen often, which I think is a nice balance because it's about, you know, having something they love that they can see living with for years, but it not being overbearing.
And my other tip, I guess, is if you can't afford a designer, just copy. Find exactly the kitchen you want. Find out what it was, what the material was. Copy the whole thing. Don't just copy some of it.
Copy the whole thing. Yeah. And you know, there's platforms like Est and, you know, that actually show a kitchen, and then you can go on and like look at all the materials that is composed by that. So that's a nice resource for people looking at, you know, stylish interiors and what that's composed of. Because it is hard to go back and start, you know, yourself trying to find that exact shade of laminate. Like, I don't want to do that. It's hard.
And inevitably, when you try and copy, when you try and pull out those things that you like from whatever, Pinterest or wherever, and you find what they are always the most expensive ones.
Of course they are. Of course. But that's why the interior, that's why those details make it look so good. Like, it's that exact shade of laminate, that exact tone of stone. Like, someone's gone and selected, especially if it's natural stone, an exact slab from a particular quarry that's come out pre-ordered. They're not just picking a Calcutta. Like, it's so specific. And I think that that's what's really beautiful about natural stone, because you can dive into that level of, you know, attention and detail. So, yeah.
I guess natural stone, Calcutta is a type of marble for anyone who doesn't know. It's a particular veiny. So marble's been around for thousands of years as a material, and engineered stone was around, now gone. And so we're in a new phase. But what's the next? What's the future? What's the product you're developing now, or other people are developing? Where is it heading? What's the bench top of the future?
There's a big, big push towards porcelain. I think if we're to look to the future, I would say look to Europe, look to Italy, look to Milan, look at the design fairs every year. every year over there. They're really great setting trends with technology and fashion. I didn't get to go myself this year to Milan Design Week, but I had several clients go, and the feedback was every single kitchen was porcelain. It was all porcelain. You can see the Europeans have definitely nailed it. They've got the stonemasons that are on board with cutting it. Now that you've got all the skill sets and all the different blades and machines, they're off and running. I think we're definitely in that process now of education and upskilling and investment in machines and blades. But yeah, you know, once these guys are up and running, once we see that, the cost of fabrication is going to come down because they're all going to be competing in the same space. At the moment, it's a little bit mixed because there is that zero silica engineered stone product out there. But we definitely see once more guys have sort of invested in that tech, the cost of the fabrication can come down. The material is the material cost. It's the same as what it was. There's nothing different there. So yeah, I'm excited to see it become much more accessible product over the next few months. But the feedback overall, we've you know, had such a success. There's a color called Bellini Bianco that we have. It was inspired by an old color we had called Da Vinci. And this color's just like, it's gone crazy. We just can't get enough of it because it's come through really cost effective. So there is still that accessible sort of range in the offering that people can go to if they want something that's relatively cost effective. So yeah, I don't think people should be scared to get it quoted. I think my advice as the supplier would be come to us and ask us who you should sort of turn to for stonemasons, because not everyone is supportive of the product, not everyone has the skill set, and not everyone will give you a reasonable quote. And that would be really, you know, if you are, go out there, do some real research, find the guys that are cutting a lot of porcelain. It doesn't have to be come to us. You could do that research on your own. But if you don't approach a stonemason that is cutting volume porcelain, you're not going to see a cost-effective quote come through.
Yeah, so come to you, because I laugh and the message is come to us.
I'm like, okay. Come to us. Of course it is.
No, like you've obviously got a network of manufacturers.
Oh, we work with around 400 stonemasons nationally. So, you know, it's a big pool of people and a lot of supportive stonemasons that are quoting extremely well. So it's just more of a shame to see when consumers reach out to a stonemason that doesn't want to quote, they don't want to work with the product. They'll just quote it really high. So the consumer then gets the perception, oh, it's really expensive. I'm like, no, it's not. That stonemason just doesn't want to cut porcelain. He wants to cut the zero silica engineered stone. And that's where that perception of cost is coming in, because there are people that are doing that. And then there's others that are cutting it, you know, the same sort of speeds as engineered stone and cutting it really cost effectively.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the quality of the tradesman is paramount. Like you can't, I mean, I would rather buy the cheapest material but have it installed by a qualified, by an experienced and good high quality tradesperson, because that will definitely look better than the most amazing material installed by an amateur, like no question.
The finish will be beautiful. You know, it's a skill set stonemasonry, and you watch the guys that cut marble and they're just, some of our clients are just amazing. Like the stuff they achieve. We've had someone actually curve our product. You can't bend this material whatsoever, but he's cut it in a way that it looks like it's this amazing curved radius. Like the things these guys that are upskilled with, they're creating such beautiful finishes. So yeah, it's been quite a fun space to be in, because everyone's pushing themselves and looking to Europe and looking to the guys over there that are doing really amazing things. And I think Australia's at this point in time is becoming really advanced with stone finishes. And I think we're going to see maybe the States follow suit. It's going to be interesting to watch what happens over there. But yeah, Australia's definitely on the ball at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I think it might be time to wrap up, and I'm normally terrible at this, but we need to have three key takeaways. I don't know what they might be. I can't, because I can't talk and think of three key takeaways, but one is certainly talk to smart stone. But I think, yeah, I think the key for me is there's options out there, and you need to consider the whole product, not just the supplies, how it's made, and also that the cost of, you may not understand the cost of the product itself if you just get a quote for a supply and install.
We'll get 2 and 3 quotes. That would be my advice, is get more than one quote. That's a really smart way to do it.
Yeah, and I guess the other key thing is that, yeah, there are alternatives. It's not the end of, like, bench tops. We're at a new beginning where it's a product that's safer. And, yeah, I don't know. What else can you add to that?
Yeah, I would think now, actually, I think the next year or two is going to be really fun sort of stage to be renovating and doing a kitchen, because the options are now more exciting and more realistic, and these materials look more like marble than they ever have. So I think it's a really positive space to be in. Obviously, you've got products like laminate that are, you know, innovating. I can't speak too much to them, but you're saying your experience with them is amazing. So they've got some really great cost-effective options. They've got some amazing porcelain surfaces out there. And then there's also some really cost-effective natural stones out there. So yeah, I don't think that anything's really negative. I think it's just, you know, a little bit having your wits with you when you go to quote and just asking lots of questions just for the next year while the space is sort of all over the place. And then once it streamlines itself, it'll, you know, it'll go back to normal.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us, and really appreciate Madalena from Smartstone. And did you want to plug have you got an event coming up? I don't know. Maybe, I don't know if we'll get for the...
Yeah, definitely. I'm also, you know, a part of an event down the south coast of Illawarra called the Illawarra Festival of Architecture and Design. So if you love all things architecture and design, definitely pop in and say hi. We've got some great keynote speakers, but that'll be an amazing weekend. If not, the Smartstone Showroom is a great place for everyone to pop in and see our materials and come and grab some samples, get some feedback from us in terms of quoting, and, you know, we can see you in the right direction, but definitely come and have a look at these beautiful new surfaces.
Tell us where it is.
We've got warehouses across the country. Showroom in Sydney is in Torella, which is quite near the airport, near Wallye Creek. We've got another facility down in Derrimut in Melbourne in Victoria. And then we've also got a showroom in Ormo between the Gold Coast and Brisbane in Queensland.
Great. Well, thank you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was lovely talking.
Really appreciate your time, Madalena from Smartstone. So thank you for being with us. Thanks also to our listeners. To access exclusive content, we invite you to join our community by subscribing to our mailing list. The link can be found in the show notes. Thank you so much. Goodbye. Till next time.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.